Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I have a great show for you today. My guest today will be Bob Musil. He is the president and CEO of the Rachel Carlson Council. He started that in February, and prior to that, for 14 years, he was the executive director and CEO of Physicians for Social Responsibility. And he also was a Nobel Prize winner back in 1985 for his work. And so I will be inviting him on in a little while to tell us more about the work he's doing at the Rachel Carlson Council, to talk about his new book, Rachel Carlson and Her Sisters, Extraordinary Women Who Have Shaped America's Environment, and all the work he's doing on the environment and global sustainability. So he will be on in a little while. Before he does, of course, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the city. It's summertime, so the amount of things going on is endless. I've just picked out a few highlights that I want to share with you. And then talk to you about some things going on in the news and some things you can do to take some action. So let's start with what's going on. Tonight is Edible Manhattan's Good Beer event. I've been telling you about that. There's still some tickets left. That's from 6 to 9 at 82 Mercer, and you can find out more information by tickets at the Edible Manhattan website. But they will be having beer from many microbreweries, as well as delicious edibles from some of the top local restaurants. So check that out. Tomorrow, August 2nd, a wonderful event is going to be happening, Moms Rising Food Power Brunch. And this is an organization or being put together by an organization, BLK, in the Bronx. And this is a food fight, moms on the front lines in schools and communities. And they're offering a free brunch from 11:30 to 1:30, but it's a full-day conference, if you're interested, called Not Just Talk Conference. And the conference is free. You can go to the momsrising.org website to find out more about it. But it's really talking about school meals and how to stop junk food companies from targeting our children, especially children of color, and to try to, you know, brainstorm and work together to take back the food that we feed our children. So this should be a really great event. I plan on going, and I hope to see some of you there. Again, it's tomorrow from 11:30 to 1:30. It's free, and it's Moms Rising Food Power Brunch. Then on August 6th is my next IE Green farm-to-table cooking class. My cooking classes have been going great. This has been an unbelievable week. I had the cooking class last Wednesday, and then on Thursday I had a farm-to-table socially responsible investing dinner, and I partnered with some folks from Morgan Stanley who have been putting together mutual funds and investments with companies that are trying to or are doing the right thing and are making socially responsible decisions. And I have been able to divest any money from fossil fuel companies or Monsanto's or biotech companies that are doing the wrong thing. And that feels really great to invest in companies that are in alignment with your moral and ethical beliefs. So we will be having actually another socially responsible investing dinner since that one filled up. It was a free offering from Morgan Stanley, so it didn't cost anything, and we closed out at 35, and we have already people signing up for the next one, which is scheduled for September 23rd. So if you want more information about that, you can let me know. So August 6th is my next one. I also had a farm-to-table yoga retreat here on Sunday, which was excellent. Also sold out. We had 16 people doing yoga out on the front lawn. We thought we were going to be rained out. Well, we wouldn't have been rained out. We were under a tent, but instead we had the brunch under the tent since the sun was shining so bright, and it was beautiful. So we're going to also be scheduling some more yoga and farm-to-table retreats. Watch out for those. But meanwhile, I do have August 6th and August 20th. There's still room in these classes. They will be farm-to-table cooking classes, harvesting some vegetables right out of the garden. And then hands-on opportunity, learn some knife skills, learn how to chop, learn some techniques in the kitchen, and really get a chance to do some cooking and then sitting down to a community meal. It's really a wonderful time. Then August 7th, Slow Food North Shore is welcoming Sip Tea Lounge, which is our newest Snail of Approval restaurant. That will be from 8 to 10 on August 7th, Thursday evening, and that's in Huntington. You can sign up on the Slow Food Huntington's website. Just to relieve any confusion, Slow Food Huntington will be transitioning to our new name, Slow Food North Shore, just so that people know that this Slow Food chapter is really all-encompassing and is not just for Huntington. August 13th, Edible Manhattan is having a seafood soiree at the Water Club, and this is a rooftop feast, all from local fish supplied by Dr. Dish, which is a wonderful, relatively new organization that is actually working with fishermen right out in Montauk and getting fish directly to restaurants. So the people from Dr. Dish will be there. I'm hoping to have Sean on my radio show one of these days. He's the founder of Dr. Dish. As well as beer from Brooklyn Brewery and cocktails from the New York State Distillers Guild. So that should be a really fun event. Oh, I skipped one. Backtracking a little, Edible East End is having their third annual Great Food Truck Derby, which is always a great event. That's August 8th from 4 to 7 at the Hayground School in Bridgehampton. And you can go to the Edible East End website to get tickets to that. But they have, you know, I don't know, around 40 food trucks, maybe even more food trucks there, all serving great edible food for your delight. So that's a really fun event. August 17th, Slow Food North Shore is having a poolside potluck and barbecue. That is the first members-only event that we've actually ever had. And we're doing that just to let members know there's a reason to join. And membership to Slow Food is a wonderful thing. Slow Food is an organization, international organization. We have over 200 chapters here in the Slow Food USA organization. And Slow Food represents good, clean, and fair food. Good for the planet, good for your body. Clean, meaning it's GMO-free, it's antibiotic-free, it's, you know, it's clean of additives and preservatives. It's simple, real food. And also fair. Fair prices, fair labor wages, all of that together wrapped up in the deliciousness of enjoying food together. And that's a piece that is really celebrated with Slow Food, the conviviality of eating and sharing a meal together. So join Slow Food Organization. It's a great organization. There's chapters in Manhattan, Slow Food East End, and Slow Food North Shore. September 7th is the North Fork Foodie Tour. And that is, actually, I think that's also being organized by Edible East End. But there's talks and demonstrations from some of North Fork's finest, including John Ross, one of North Fork's premier chefs, and Andy Lowry, who will talk about oyster farming. And you can chart your own course for the day. They, you know, picked out lots of different farms and food places for you to go to, great local food and wine. And tickets are $25 for adults and free for children under 12. So that looks like a fun event. That's from 10 to 4 on September 7th. Save the date for the Just Food Let Us Eat Local event. That happens every year. That's September 17th. And then, of course, September 21st, you're going to be hearing a lot more about this, the People's Climate March. It's going to be the largest climate march in history, scheduled for New York City. The United Nations will be having a summit on climate change that weekend, the September 20th and 21st. So scheduled for September 21st, it's going to be a huge, huge rally. I don't know if the march is actually marching anywhere, but it's a huge rally outside of the UN. The Long Island Food Coalition, which is our new organization trying to bring together all organizations dedicated to food together. We will be there, representing Long Island, as well as the Brooklyn Food Coalition will be there with all of Brooklyn foodies. So save that date, September 21st, for the People's Climate March. And as I mentioned, September 23rd, we'll have another one of those socially responsible investing dinners. So that's what's going on in and around the city. Like I said, lots of stuff. Things that are in the news that I wanted to share with you. There's a great new app that you can get on your phone, an app that will tell you which politicians are selling out and how much private monies and lobbying money has gone to this politician, and then you can look at how they're voting. And this is really great. It was developed by a 16-year-old, Nick Rubin, and the app is called Greenhouse. And I think it's going to be great. So check out this new app. Young kid is really doing some amazing things. So you can find out what politicians are being bought out and how they're voting. Also, in the news is the misuse of antibiotics. I cannot believe this. I'm so disappointed. But despite FDA scientific findings, that most antibiotics that are being formulated in this country are being used on livestock, and they have now agreed to allow that to continue, even though science is showing that antibiotics in livestock is really affecting the outcome of people being antibiotic resistant to certain types of disease, and we need to stop this practice. However, they just approved allowing it to continue. So that's really disappointing. You can take some action and sign some petitions to help make schools commercial-free. On my website, there's a petition for that. And there's also a petition to label meat that's using antibiotics. So let's push for that, as well as, of course, the GMO labeling law, which we want to try to enact. So these are all ways that you can get involved. Check out my website at iegreen.com, and please sign these petitions. So now, before I invite Bob on to talk to us about his work, I want to share with you a quick recipe for a blueberry raspberry pie. I made this for the Socially Responsible Investing Dinner Party, this recipe will be posted both on the PRN website and on mine with photos, so you can see just how to lay out the crust. So this is a whole wheat pastry crust, and it's easy to make. It's 2 cups of organic whole wheat pastry flour, 2 cups of organic unbleached white flour, 2 teaspoons salt, 2 sticks of butter, and 1/2 cup of cold water plus 2 tablespoons. The filling is 4 pints of fresh or frozen organic blueberries, 2 pints of fresh or frozen organic raspberries, 2 organic Granny Smith apples that you peel and core and add. The apples, the pectin from the apples just help hold the filling together. 1/2 cup of honey or organic sugar or maple syrup, whichever you prefer. 2 tablespoons of lemon juice, 1 1/2 teaspoons cinnamon, and 3 tablespoons of organic white flour. And to make the pie crust, you put the flour in a large bowl. With a pastry knife, cut in the butter until all the butter is incorporated into the flour. And it will look like little pebbles. Then you make a well in the center of the bowl, pour in the water, and with your hands, with your fingers separated, you're just going to fluff up the flour with the water in the center so that you're not mixing it. You're really kind of just incorporating the water into the flour. And you want to mix it up as minimally as possible, but until you can form balls. And you're going to form 2 balls for the crust, the top crust and the bottom crust. You will have extra dough when you trim it, which you can use for something else at another time. But I like to have enough dough to work with so that I'm not trying to piece the dough together in order to fit the pie pan. I use a large pie pan. It's a 10-inch pie shell, so that you really have a nice big pie. So you're going to make a ball with the crust and first press it down and press it in at the same time so that you're making a nice patty with the dough. And then you roll it out, starting from the center, rolling it out to the edge until it's until it's thin all the way around. And then you're going to trim it so that it's, you know, round before you fold it in half and then put it onto the pie crust and then unfold it. I know it sounds complicated and I don't want to take too much time, but if you look at the photos, it will be really clear for you. And then the filling, you just combine all the ingredients into a large bowl, put it into the bottom crust, and then you're going to roll out the top crust and put that on top. And I also have a way of, you want to make little slits in the top of the crust. And if you look at the photos, you'll be able to see how to do that. And then you put the top crust on and you pinch the edges together. You trim it so that the top crust and the bottom crust are the same size. And then you roll the crust together, pinching them together and crimping them so that they're decorative and they hold together. And so the fruit will cook. And you know it's ready. You're going to bake it in a 325 oven for 15 minutes, then lower the temperature to 375 and bake for about another 40 minutes or so until it's bubbling. And you'll see the juices coming out of the slits that you made in the top of the crust, and that's when you know it's ready. And that is it. Enjoy the recipe. Of course, give me feedback. I'd love to know how it turned out. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Robert Musil, also known to his friends as Bob. He is the president and CEO of the Rachel Carson Council, which is a legacy organization envisioned by Rachel Carson and founded in 1965. And Bob Musil is only the third president and CEO of this historic environmental group. Bob also worked as the executive director and CEO for the Physicians for Social Responsibility for 14 years and was also working for another organization that he'll tell us about during the time when they won the Nobel Prize for Peace. And I'm going to just let Bob tell you more about what he is doing, because he is a real mover and shaker and has been doing this work for a long time. Oh, when he was working for SANE Education Fund. Bob, are you with us?
I am. Good morning, Bhavani. I'm drooling over your recipe.
Ah, it was good.
I run to the kitchen and bake it right now, but it is fabulous. And, of course, we at the Rachel Carson Council love the term organic, because, as you know, Rachel did not like pesticides and other nasty chemicals. But I'm doing great. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. So before the Rachel Carson Council, which I want to talk about, you were the longest standing president and CEO of the Physicians for Social Responsibility, were you not?
Yes.
Can you share with
you
us
don't
the
want
work
to say
that...
How long. Yes, it was quite long, and it was just a wonderful organization, and I stopped to write books and lecture around the country, and then I ran into the Rachel Carson Council while writing my book, Rachel Carson and Her Sisters, Extraordinary Women Who Shaped America's Environment, which is how I got connected to the Rachel Carson Council. But PSR was my main thing for many years, with a wonderful staff and physicians and citizens around the country, connected globally, and working on the environment and on peace.
So Physicians for Social Responsibility were also involved in peace. Did they work with Doctors Without Borders?
Only as colleagues. Doctors Without Borders, which I should say won the Nobel Peace Prize also, but later, does primarily direct humanitarian service overseas. Physicians mm-hmm. for Social Responsibility was primarily an advocacy group trying to get rid of nuclear weapons, prevent wars. We led the opposition to the Iraq War. And in terms of environmental issues, that I moved the organization in that direction. We worked a lot on global climate change and, of course, on trying to ban and get rid of various pesticides, herbicides, and nasty stuff. So it was sort of one of the few groups. The other of the big groups here in Washington, D.C., that formed what's called the Green Group, the coalition of large leading groups, the only ones that ever really mixed those issues, peace, chemicals, climate change, those kinds of things, would be Greenpeace, which was founded back during the days of open-air nuclear testing, as mm-hmm. was PSR. and occasionally Friends of the Earth and sometimes the Sierra Club. The others, understandably, were founded to work on nature and parks and trees and other things.
Right. Well, as we all know, and most of the listeners here know, that global warming and working on the environment and the pesticides, you know, everything is so interconnected that it's really hard to just focus on one thing because they are all interrelated. And I think Rachel Carson was one of the first people to, you know, with her book Silent Spring, to really, you know, to really bridge those two worlds of nature and conservation, preserving nature, with the pesticides and the environment and what is happening with the use of...
Exactly. I mean, you know, and that's what I had been interested in Rachel Carson, but when I wrote the book and ran into the council, it's precisely that holistic vision, this sense, what she talked about, the problem was the hubris, the old Greek term for, and I'll use the term man's for, it's mostly males, but we'll use it sort of generically, arrogance, the sense that we control nature, we control the planet, we can fix anything, we can build something that will solve this problem, whether it's a nuclear bomb or DDT. And for her, that was the real issue. And that what she felt one of the important counters to that, and I think you're doing with radio and cooking and so on, was feeling, imagination, awe, wonder, a sense of reverence for the life that we have each and every day. And without that, all of the science, all of the studies wouldn't really finally make a difference. And that, for me, is the enduring legacy of Rachel Carson. And that's why I'm doing what I do.
Mm-hmm. And you're doing amazing things. So you actually started writing this book, Rachel Carson and Her Sisters, prior to coming into contact with the Rachel Carson Council.
I did. I'm sorry to say, I did not know about them, and I was getting permission for a cover photo on my book, which is a glorious picture of Rachel Carson sitting on the rocks looking at hawks passing over Hawk Mountain in Pennsylvania.
It is. It's a beautiful photo. I'm looking at it right now.
I want to market Rachel Carson leather jackets. It's really cool. Anyhow. That's what got me connected to them, and then I discovered that their very long-time director had retired, and they were without a leader and hadn't found someone that they thought could do what they needed. And I do a lot of politics on the Hill and with the EPA, with the Obama administration, with the Congress when it's doing something, and I speak around the country. So I thought
they just enacted to sue President Obama.
Well, that's right. That's considered.
That's something.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the things I, you know, and I know you may want to ask me certain things, but I just want to say about Rachel Carson, because also I know from lecturing on college campuses that Rachel died 50 years ago, and she's not always well known unless I'm speaking to environmental science or environmental studies majors, or maybe some young people with a keen sense of history, or maybe their parents are nature.
Or they went to a Waldorf school.
Yes, in Garden.
That's how come I know of her, you know, is in the Waldorf schools, because she not only loved nature and environment, but the feeling and the imagination and the awe, that is all what Waldorf school education is trying to
with
everybody.
And I'm sorry, because you let a guy who just read a book onto your program, is that one of Rachel's closest friends and allies who actually helped her was a teacher at the Waldorf School in Garden City.
And which one?
Marjorie Spock.
Uh-huh.
For your time, Marjorie Spock, for listeners who don't know, the 20th century had a leading pediatrician, Dr. Ben Spock, who was the leading baby book. But then he made the mistake of opposing the draft, opposing the Vietnam War, opposing nuclear weapons, joining SANE. And so he got the usual attacks that we're familiar with these days if you speak out for truth and peace and justice. But his sister, Marjorie Spock, brought the suit against DDT spraying that kicked off a movement that was opposed to this, that Rachel wrote about. She got scientific information, legal documents, all from a smoky old Thermofax machine in the late 50s from Marjorie Spock, who was way ahead of her time. She had a lifetime committed partner, a woman named Polly Richards. They lived comfortably on the north shore of Long Island and had acres and acres of organic gardens. They were had an alternative lifestyle. And then in those days, if you've, any of your listeners have seen old documentaries, the planes flew over and just sprayed everything. It didn't matter that you were down below with organic gardens. And so she convinced, I joke around too much, I say, you know, if you're going to pollute and pour chemicals on people, never pick wealthy people. Big mistake. Uh-huh. Big mistake. She got wealthy friends on the North Shore of Long Island and others noted. They banded together and they had the money and the means to bring suit. And that is actually the backstory of Silent Spring, and it goes to the Waldorf School. And I'll stop there, except to say that that combination of wanting to live a life that is close to nature, has feeling and awe, but also standing up. You know, this is outrageous. You can't do this. And that sense of fighting back is something that Rachel Carson, Marjorie Spock, and many other women in my book, it's what inspired me. I thought, man, these women were battled at every time. They were called nasty names. The worst you could say in the 50s was spinster, which mm-hmm. meant some horrible thing. I don't know. But they are so inspiring. And because what has kept me going, and I've had a pretty long career, is others who stand up and fight and are frankly bolder and braver than I am. And I discovered that there were women doing this for the 150 years that I never heard of before. So I thought that was pretty outrageous. So I thought, okay, I'll write a book about it.
Right. Well, nothing's new or special about women not getting credit where women's due. I mean, you know, my daughter who's, you know, has a doctorate in art history and is working at the Brooklyn Museum at the Feminist Art Collection and, you know, all about feminist artists. You know, look at how many women artists are in the Museum of Modern Art. It's like three, I think. You know, it's unbelievable. And there were certainly lots of women doing art. So women are, you know, used to not getting credit where credit's due. So it's wonderful that you picked up on that. You want to share some of the women that you discovered?
Yeah, sure, because I'm always a little embarrassed. I didn't know about these things, but
neither did others. Well, you and everybody else.
Yeah, that's right. Except, you know, here and there, a scholar or a feminist scholar in particular would have written a book sometimes in the 70s or 80s after the second wave of feminism. One of my favorites is a woman from upstate New York that I know when I talk to people, they think they might know who it is, but her name is Susan Fenimore Cooper. And older listeners will say, James Fenimore Cooper? Is that his wife? And younger college audiences, I'll say, well, haven't you seen The Last of the Mohicans with Daniel Day-Lewis? And mm-hmm. then I realize that film came out when they were born. So I skip along and explain that Susan Fenimore Cooper was the daughter of a noted novelist. She herself was a novelist who wrote, of course, anonymously in the mid-19th century. She edited and helped her father, she was a dutiful daughter, with all of his many prize-winning, best-selling works. Because he became a famous author and wealthy, they lived for a time in Paris and London, where she studied and knew all of the great French naturalists, botanists, evolutionists at the Jardin des Plantes in Paris, and then came back to the U.S. and wrote a book called Rural Hours that is really the first popular, big-time nature writing book 4 years before Thoreau's Walden. In fact, Henry David Thoreau quotes Susan Fenimore Cooper as an expert on birds and other issues. And so it is a lovely and beautifully written description of nature, small-time life, the decline of the Oneida Indians. It's a marvelous book filled with both science and feeling and wonder. And it's our first big naturalist. But the story is better than that, and I'll try to go fast because then we're on radio. Susan Fenimore Cooper, this book, and I have to tell you, it just had big-time leather editions, popular in England, around the world. She was a bestseller. She was the Rachel Carson of her day. She lived to a ripe old age, as some of these women did, And by the end of her career, toward the very late 19th century, she started worrying about the decline of the birds, of species, and joined in with the then younger women who led the battle against the slaughter of birds in the U.S. and worldwide for women's hats, which, of course, were covered not only sometimes with the feathers of herons, egrets, sometimes entire birds. And so Susan Fenimore Cooper joined in with those folks, wrote a lament for the birds, fought for the Migratory Bird Act. This is when she's an old lady, an older woman. And she wrote in a popular magazine that Rachel Carson's mother got and read to Rachel all the time. So there's a direct connection between some of these early women who developed our concern, not just for the birds and the robins, but also for the destruction of nature, the destruction of birds. She, Susan Fenimore Cooper, I'll just add, wrote about the beginnings of clear-cutting. She warned about cutting down all the forests. And, of course, she had this sort of lovely, haughty view in which she would say, any boor with an axe can cut down a tree, but it would take generations to replace. And even then, it is not the stately, impressive tree. And she wrote about how you could plant trees, the land would be worth more. Early sense of ecosystem services. So that's the first woman nature writer, ecologist, environmentalist in the book, and there are many others, and you know, we'd have to talk all day, but they're just amazing, and I hope that people learn more and are inspired to act. That's, you know, I didn't do this just as a history book. I do teach sometimes at American University, but unless people, I believe, are inspired to act and do something about the problems they see, then you might as well just, you know, I don't know, put your feet up and have a drink.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I'm about. I really try to get people to take action because there are so many issues, like I was saying, and, you know, and it's almost impossible to really take action on all of them, but they are also interconnected. So there, you know, are simple actions people can take, like, you know, sign a petition. That's easy. You know, call your representatives. That's pretty easy. But, you know, something you said about the spraying of DDT and, you know, how that made Marjorie Spock crazy, you know, with her organic garden. Well, I have the same thing when they're spraying for the mosquitoes out here on Long Island. You know, how do you suggest, you know, people fight that? I mean, I've certainly called and they said there's nothing we can do. So what do you think people can do, having learned from the research you did in your book? What can people do to try to band together to stop this spraying? Because my organic garden, they don't tell you when it's going to happen.
It's to document what's going on. I'm dealing with a couple of people who've called the Rachel Carson Council. Same thing, people spraying on their near their property, the chemicals drift in, or in your case, it sounds like entire neighborhoods. I don't know.
Yeah, they just cover all of Long Island for the mosquitoes, you know, because there's a lot of mosquitoes, so they're just spraying for West Nile.
Well, the first step is to find out what's being sprayed and then working with, I know this is going to sound complicated, but unless you can say that they're spraying X and Y and Z and here's how it harms, and there are a number of good groups, Rachel Carson Council is one, in New York, Environmental Defense Fund was founded over these issues, you know, years ago, and then find someone to help. The simple version is it takes organizing and organizations that people do get frustrated. If you just, I don't mean to minimize one's phone call or letter or email, but if that's, you know, then you're going to get the bureaucratic response, thank you for your letter, I'm so sorry, goodbye. And until there's a group or a band or a bunch connected to probably an organization that has some clout, but in the case of Rachel Carson, it started also people wrote angry letters to the newspapers, and now that would be both letters to the editor but also blogs and all that, stirring it up, writing. Rachel had friends who wrote about the issue we're talking about, Long Island papers, Boston Globe. This is in addition and before the lawsuits. But documenting what it is and finding some other neighbors or people in the town who are influential. You know, I'm working now with a group of chains of garden and nursery stores that have banned chemicals, and particularly the neonics,
neonicotinoids,
yes, that harm the bees and other things, and they won't sell them. And so if you're dealing in this area, that's Benke's Nursery and American Plant Company, then you've got some people, and then there are alternative ways to deal with it. So if you start to get just a few local but well-known allies, well, of course they would benefit if everyone rushed to their store and got organic mosquito stuff, of which there's plenty. We don't have time to talk about the brands and the kinds. And we just put on our website at www.rachelcarsoncouncil.org 27 tips on how to prevent mosquitoes in your yard. Most of them are pretty obvious and well-known, but people forget. I realized I hadn't, like cleaning, keeping the gutters clean. You know, I clean out my bird bath, and I make sure I don't have too much standing water. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I haven't looked at those gutters in a million years, mosquito breeders. Short answer to your question, document it. Find local allies, probably environmental organizations, and in some cases, I would say, you know, I'm sure they must be on Long Island. We have nursery chains and others who are wouldn't like this any more than you do, and then you start in. I happen to live in a district, a congressional district, with an environmentalist Democratic leader named Chris Van Hollen, so I would just call him up. I'm not sure where you are on Long Island, but you're in Old Westbury.
Old Westbury, near Garden City.
Ah, well, who's there now? Oh, is Carolyn McCarthy retired?
No, she's still there, I think.
Well, I may have to talk to Carolyn. I know her because, as you know, her husband was killed on the same railroad train. My dad wasn't on the train when her husband was killed, but that's the train. She only lives about a mile where I grew up. But that's, you know, finding an ally, once you've done the very local thing, whether it's some big nurseries or, you know, anyhow, that's calling attention. And keeping at it. It can be frustrating.
Right, keeping at it.
People, because I forget when I see people putting those little flags that they've done pesticides on their lawn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I get real angry and run up and rip out their sign and say, you idiot, then I have to realize, no, they haven't heard of the Rachel Carson Council. They haven't looked at the latest health study. They're told by many nursery places you need to keep your lawn green, the mosquitoes down, and so they're, you know, you got to keep at it.
You do have to keep at it. Well, on this note, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I actually would like to talk a little bit about, you know, things that you think that people can do to keep at it, because there is, you know, there's ways about going about it, and, you know, and I know you also have done so much work with the environment and working at it for so long that you have lots of things you can share with us. So everyone who's listening, I'm talking with Bob Musil. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. And you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Bob Musil. He is the president and CEO of the Rachel Carson Council and has been a longtime worker in global sustainability, security, and health issues. Bob, are you with us?
I sure am. I still didn't get to make that luscious organic recipe you started out your program with, but it's great to be back with you. And we were talking about what people can do.
Right. And, you know, as an expert, I mean, I want to make sure that we talk about your first book, too, Hope for a Heated Planet, How Americans Are Fighting Global Warming and Building a Better Future. Because you actually... you know, in that book, you're a little bit optimistic. You know, you talk about all the grassroots organizations and how that's, you know, building and how people are really trying to come together around the cures for global warming. That was in 2009.
Right.
Here we are 5 years forward. Are you disappointed? Do you feel like we're still moving on the right in the right direction, or do you feel like, you know, the issue of the money, the corporations' money, is getting in the way? You know,
I'm not ready to write despair for a heated planet, but you know, I wrote the book. Actually, I had hoped that it would come out during the primaries before President Obama was elected. It came out as he was elected. And it reflects that sense of that period that we are making a difference. People are beginning to get the message. And when President Obama came in, you know, everybody knows there was a great sense of hope and optimism and joy, in fact. And he did some wonderful things that people have forgotten about, maybe historians will talk about. You know, everyone talks about the economy, but the large part of the response to the economy was a series of measures that included those to build renewable energy. And so we started out very strong. And, of course, both houses of Congress and the White House were in the hands of the Democrats. We forget that there was a joint global climate change task force headed by my old friend and colleague, Representative Ed Markey, now Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts, who goes back to the nuclear freeze days with me when we headed some big, big, big efforts. So we were making progress. What looks and what can be discouraging is that the Congress has not passed anything, so it looks like nothing is happening. And further, we get a lot of crazy right-wing Koch brothers-funded propaganda and confusing stories about climate change from corporate entities. So the people think, isn't there still a debate? Or, I don't know, I'm confused. The truth is, of course, there is no scientific debate. It's been just gone over and over and over and over again by worldwide peer-reviewed scientists. And that has been the case since at least the Carter administration. I'll just throw in a quick word. Rachel Carson, who we were talking about, before she died, she worked very closely politically with President Kennedy, with his Secretary Udall of the Interior, working to try to pass legislation, get what became the EPA, get rid of chemicals, and she was aware of global climate change. There were reports from the Conservation Foundation. The earliest measurements were coming in from Hawaii that our CO2 was going up and that this would warm the planet. So for, you know, advanced scientific types, we've known about this for 50 years. If mm-hmm. you're counting from the Carter administration, where a friend of mine was Jimmy Carter's environmental person, we're talking 40 years. If you're talking Al Gore's earliest hearings in the 80s, 30 years. So it can be frustrating, but what we've got, we have an international treaty, and we can get another one in Paris in 2015 if people push. We have state efforts all over the place. People remember Arnold Schwarzenegger, and leaving aside his other attributes, he helped pass a whole series of things in California, advanced. There are more than 30 states that have climate action plans, reducing their emissions, cities, states, mayors, their religious organizations, Christians, Jews, others. There are, the list goes on so much that there is a lot happening. And I just saw a poll the other day that Americans lag behind almost every big country you can name with our belief in climate science. So, but the grassroots movements are there. And what can people do? I was just at a very impressive anti-fracking rally. Your listeners know that's hydraulic fracturing. You pump water and chemicals and junk down to break up the shale and get the gas. And it was broiling hot. And people from all over come out and marched from the capital area over to the FERC, that's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, that is giving the go-ahead so far to a place called Cove Point here in Maryland that will refine natural gas and ship it overseas, fracked natural gas. So people are upset. The only thing that to be simple, there is stuff going on around the world, internationally, in this country at levels. Organizations are growing. There are more. So all that is holding us back is a small group that controls right now one house of the U.S. Congress and a bunch of people who pump advertising and fake studies into the media. Everyone else, the majority, is concerned. And so I'm still hopeful, but it does require that each of us who care and know about this stuff keep yakking. Seems like you and I think, like to talk. And, yeah, talk neighbors, friends, colleagues, on the air, right. But I see signs all the time in terms of demonstrations. There's going to be a major climate rally in New York City. I realize Old Westbury is New York. On September 21st, people will turn out by the thousands. It is no longer the case that climate change is unknown or in doubt. People are in action. They're in motion. One of the women in my book from Rachel Carson and her sisters is named Sandra Steingraber. She has written three marvelous books. One, her first and best known, Living Downstream. She's a PhD biologist and poet who was inspired by Rachel Carson, ran around early militant breast cancer marches with other women waving copies of Silent Spring and signs that said Rachel Carson was right, ban pesticides, get this stuff out. And you know there are big clusters of and problems with breast cancer on Long Island for a number of reasons. So Sandra, who is one of the Rachel Carsons of our time, was out at this rally. She not only writes books and lectures and all that the way I do, out there leading people in anti-fracking rallies. They brought suit in New York State against fracking. So it's raising some hell, and people are doing it. In answer to what people can do, you know, to go back a little bit, I think it depends on what people are comfortable with and who they are. Some people have always been bold and will take militant action and go get arrested. A bunch did at the FERC, at this rally. They went up, lay down there, and they got themselves arrested.
I did a couple summers ago for the tar sands with Bill McKibben.
There you go. See, there, with, you know, with the tar sands, if people are, you know, for your listeners probably know, you're referring to, there's both weeks and weeks and weeks of civil disobedience at the White House, followed by rallies to surround the White House, all about the XL Keystone pipeline that will take crude oil crushed out of tar sands, ruin Alberta and Canada, pump it and leak and all the way down to the Gulf, and still get pumped overseas, sent overseas, and ruin global climate change. So there we are at these huge rallies. If you're artistic, you know, and we're in the artsy crowd in high school or college, there are these incredible long dancing snake-like lines of pipeline and people doing art and puppets and stuff like that. If you like to talk like I do, there are people up at the microphone and with the bullhorn. You know, stop it now. If you're quiet and supportive and a researcher, there are people sitting there at the computer doing the research, figuring out what are the chemicals, where do these pipelines go. I have friends who create maps and apps and websites where you can see where the damn pipeline is going. Just click on it. There is something for everybody to do. You don't have to be a big, loud leader. And I try to tell college students all the time, you have special gifts. You are special. I sound, you know, like Mr. Rogers. You are special. And whatever it is you do best can be turned and used. Music, art, literature, radio, demonstrations, lawsuits, lawyers, business people. I work with so many business people who are concerned about this because it's their business, their friends, their family, their kids that are at risk. So I, when people say, what can I do? If you're just starting out, there's so many things. My first book, Hope for Heated Planet, is available in a special summer sale on our website. Can I do this?
Yes, you can.
RachelCarsonCouncil.org. We have a sizzling summer sale. My current book, Rachel Carson and Her Sisters, and my first book on climate change and what grassroots people are doing about it, Hope for a Heated Planet, together with free shipping and an introductory membership to the Rachel Carson Council, all for $25. You just go to the website.
Great.
But in, in Hope for a Heated Planet, I describe how I was skeptical, forgive me, of individual efforts I spent most of my career working on national and international issues, going to international negotiations, going down to the Hill, talking to senators, and I thought, you know, if you tell people plant a garden and that's going to solve it, that's no good. And my staff, bless their souls, said, Bob, you're out of it. You know, people need to know what they can do. They can't all fly to international negotiations, okay? So began to rethink this position. And so that book, Hope for You to Plant, is filled with things from planting trees. My own home was, when I moved into Bethesda, hotter than hell, a suburban brick colonial with lawn and no trees. And it's 100 and humid here in the summer, and it's getting worse, mm-hmm. thanks to climate change. I now look out on little wooded areas with wildflowers. I got so many huge trees that in 20-something years, it's got a little bit of, it's a suburb, but sort of forest quality, and it cuts down on the air conditioning. That cuts down on the emissions, on energy use, and on and on. And I wrote about how, I say if you start it with the individual level, I've now learned that once you figure out, I should plant a tree and do some of my own vegetables and make them organic, and then you just start looking at the world differently, and you say to the grocer, how come you don't have more? I know people go to Whole Foods and so on, but I also go to grocery stores that have unions. and so I say, how about some more? I don't want to have to go over to that non-union place. So you start there. And there are many, many things, and my book, Hope for You to Plant, is full, and of course there are many, many others. Mm-hmm. So I do now encourage people, start small, but look out, because it'll lead you to bigger things.
Right. And also the divesting I was talking about earlier in the show, that Bill McKibben is really pushing, divesting in any companies that have to do with fossil fuel or Monsanto or anything like that. Get out of them and don't help support them.
There's also the positive version of that. Bhavani, now if we're talking, and this is terrible, but if people, at my age, people have to have some retirement funds, or if people are fortunate enough to have, a 401k or a 403b and putting stuff aside for retirement, mm-hmm. you can also steer it positively. Yes, you can divest, as Bill and others have been urging colleges to do. As you know, Stanford University dumped $16 billion worth of holdings in coal. It's just fabulous.
I hadn't heard that. That's great.
Others have not responded as well. Harvard, which has the largest endowment by far, 30-some-odd billion, I think, reviewed the situation and said it would send the wrong message if we, started our investments politically. They'll be back at it at Harvard, you can bet. But it is growing. It's happening. But individuals, I have a financial advisor here in D.C. He's just a guy who's active locally in environmental stuff. He's a broker. And he creates climate change portfolios.
Right.
That he knows this stuff. And so you can both positively, that's the other thing. So I want to invest in some geothermal or some solar or...
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. That's great.
Yeah, I know that. Particularly, obviously, for middle class or dare I say, people who live around Nassau County, many of them probably have a little bit of money that they could do better with.
Right.
That's another piece.
Another day, because we are just about out of time, and I just want to thank you so much for your life work. I mean, you've just reading over your bio and getting to know what you do has been really amazing to me, and I just want to thank you so much.
Well, this is
on behalf of myself and everyone that's listening for the work that you're doing, because you're really making a difference.
Okay, and I'm going to go bake your organic recipe right now.
Okay, enjoy it. And everybody who's been listening, thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you next week again. Bye-bye.